there are, in addition to the 25 delegates whose names I read, 3 delegates to be elected at the state convention of the Republican Party, and those 3 delegates at large to be proposed to that convention have been designated. One is Mrs. Marge Howard, the state chairwoman of the Republican Party, and I'd like to introduce Mrs. Howard. And another one of those designates at large, who has already been introduced, but I will present him again, P. Kenneth Peterson, the state chairman. The third of the 3 delegates at large on the Stassen slate to be elected by the state convention is Governor C. Elmer Anderson, who could not be here this evening because of an engagement in Duluth, Minnesota, but he sent this telegram to the meeting. Sorry, I am unable to be with you tonight because of a long arranged trip to Duluth. Add my best wishes and greetings to the others coming to Harold Stassen tonight as Minnesota's favorite son candidate. A record of good, honest government such as he established here in Minnesota is badly needed in Washington now. Best regards, C. Elmer Anderson, Governor of Minnesota. Now, there are some old friends of Harold Stassen here tonight who are particular old friends from South St. Paul. And we polled the whole lot of them, and they said they didn't want to make any speeches, but they would like to be heard from here tonight. I present to you John Marthaler and his associate members of the Hook'em Cows from South St. Paul. John, what's your name? The Hook'em Cows in Chicago on the 7th of July to make some noise in even greater volume at the Republican National Convention. We have asked Senator Edward J. Thigh to come out to Minnesota tonight, and he's made a special trip here to attend this meeting. Senator Thigh needs no introduction to this group or to any audience of Republicans in Minnesota. He succeeded Harold Stassen as governor of Minnesota and carried on the magnificent tradition of that administration that began in 1939 on January 2 and continued on as one of the outstanding members of the United States Senate, where he now represents the state of Minnesota and the people of Minnesota as the senior senator from this state. It is a very great honor and a privilege for me to present to you Senator Edward J. Thigh.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Berger. Harold Stassen, and all the distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, you're all friends to me. I'm glad of the opportunity to be here with you tonight. It is somewhat like old times. There are many, many familiar faces that were with us back 14 years ago. There are some young faces, there are some new faces that were not with us back in 14 years ago. But it is pleasant to be at such a gathering as we have here tonight. And never a time in all the history of America have the nation and its citizens, its people, been faced with the problems and the responsibilities that we're faced with at the present time. We cannot make any mistakes. We haven't any slack, either in the possibility of governmental indebtedness, nor have we the time to make mistakes in. What we do this year is more important than has ever been the problems or the decisions by the leaders and the citizens of this nation before, as great as they are now. Why do I say this? We're in the seventh year since the ending of World War II, a global war wherein we were successful, the great casualties that we suffered, the huge national indebtedness incurred, and through the errors and mistakes and poor policies of this administration, we're back again at war, where we have more than 100,000 casualties, youth in the very flower of life, from the Korean crisis that is often referred to as police action, but war in all of its horribleness. Now then, I've stated if we make mistakes, we have no slack to work in. If you and I examine what the cost has been in the rehabilitation of Western European countries and the occupation of Germany, and when you think about the cost to this government in the rehabilitation of the economies of all the islands in the South Pacific, as well as the occupation of Japan, and unless we are successful in winning this so-called police action and Cold War that we're engaged in diplomatically, in the field of diplomacy, it will ultimately be a shooting war. And if we have spent the billions that has been spent in the attempt to build up the economies, not only of Japan, but Western Europe, in order that we could have nations and citizens standing with us fighting against communism, in order that mankind might remain free and that Christianity might survive, if that has been our expense, think what it would be following World War III with all the horrors that the atomic energy will bring to modern warfare. Think what it would be if we had to occupy China, a nation with 470 million of people. Think what it would be after we would have crushed Russia, and we'd crush her if we ever were compelled to go to war with her. Think what her economy would be like. Think of the devastation that we'd have to bring to Russia. You couldn't leave the mob of people existing somewhere in remote areas. You'd have to occupy that country. You'd have to rebuild its economies and reestablish the society of peoples within that country. Think of the burden upon this nation, because at the present time, all the leaders or all the leadership of the earth is looking to us to aid them in giving mankind the leadership that'll bring order out of the chaos that the world is today faced with. This is the problem that Christianity, freedom-loving people are faced with. If we can't bring order out of the chaos that is in the world today, if we haven't the leadership to bring that order, then the final will be that when we have built a great military strength in this country, and then a great military strength will be built over there back of the Russian curtain, and if they ever clash, then we would suffer what you and I don't know today. I serve on the Appropriations Committee. I serve on the Military Subcommittee. I've seen all the plans that the Atomic Energy Commission is bringing forth. I've seen everything that is developed now in the new type of war gadgets and new types of artillery, and the plans and the designs of the guided missile. And therefore, I say we have no slack to work in. It is now, and if we make a mistake in this year, and unless we are able to elect a strong leader that is proven in the field of diplomacy, we will not be able to settle the affairs of the world diplomatically, but what it may result into a shooting war. Therefore, to me, as I have been privileged to associate with the leaders of this nation, both in the legislative branch of the Senate of the United States, and having had an opportunity to observe all the men over on the congressional side, having had the good fortune to become personally acquainted with most of the governors of this nation, working with them as I did as a fellow governor, and later observing and working with them on the national level, having had an opportunity to praise those men, and I'm 11 years older than Harold Stassen. And therefore, I've had an opportunity to appraise him, not only in these recent years, but way back there more than 18 years ago, when he was a young county attorney in the county that I resided in. And me being 11 years older at that time, he was at that time a very young man. And I have never seen a man that has any more ability than Harold Stassen, whether it's administratively, whether it is dealing with a financial budget, or whether it's dealing with international problems. And I've seen him before the various congressional groups in Washington, informally in the District of Columbia hearing room, when 18 or more of the men left the Senate floor and walked in there to sit down and discuss international and national affairs with him. I have seen him before congressional groups, such as a club of the House members, when they had shrewdly studied what questions they were going to propound to him in that conference, in that public meeting. And I saw the man, the young man that he was in the presence of many of them there in that assembly, answered those questions intelligently, directly, and most positively. And of the men that I've been privileged to make the acquaintance of in this nation, I know of no one that is better qualified diplomatically to cope and to give to all the peoples of this earth that is looking for leadership. I've never seen a man better qualified in that field than Harold Stassen. And I've seen him before angry mobs, and I've seen him before some very shrewd, not only business people, but congressional members, when they were endeavoring not only to hackle them into anger, but also to in an attempt to confuse him and to take him off his defense. And if we win and establish order throughout this earth without war, we're going to have to do it in the political diplomatic field, conferences, and I know of no man that is better qualified to sit down in such international conferences than Harold Stassen. And that's the reason. That's the reason why I'm supporting him. As I stated before, we have very little slack. We have a national indebtedness of $260-some billion. We know that if we give the president the budget request that he has asked for, that we'll incur another $14 billion in national debts. There'll be no new taxes voted this year. And if the president receives the budget request that he's asked for, that $14 billion additional deficit would be added to. And at the present time, the maximum debt allowed for this nation is $275 billion. We have no slack. We have no time. It is Christianity and freedom-loving people fighting against communism. We either win diplomatically, or we'll be thrown into the catastrophe of a global war with all of its atomic horribleness. And therefore, you and I have a greater responsibility than just an ordinary political campaign. It is a campaign as to whether this nation and all the others go forward to freedom, or whether we'll be thrown over into the terribleness of war in the course of possibly 5, 10 or more years. It's your children, it is mine, it's their children that you and I've got to fight for, as well as ourselves. And we must nominate a man that can be elected. And I know that if in the event we nominate Harold Stassen, he'll take care of his own in the period of the national campaign and win the election. I've been privileged to present to you Harold Stassen tonight. And it's now my great pleasure to give to you, the one man whom I hope we nominate and that we elect in this year of 1952, Errol Spencer.
Mrs. Lund, Mrs. Howard, Berger, Peterson, distinguished guests, hook'em cows, friends. A few minutes ago, as I see it, from the effervescent hands of my hook'em cow friends, you heard the starting guns on the most terrific campaign ever to be waged in America, with the goal of throwing out of Washington those blundering, corrupt little group of men as a group of mismanaged Missouri messmates, and throw them out for the good of America. And I'd like to make very clear at the very opening of my remarks at this opening campaign meeting that we do not seek to throw them out for any goal of public office or for any matter of changing from party to party. But we're driving forward in this tremendous surge to throw them out because of our deep conviction that only by doing that can we have the chance in America of defeating those atheistic, communist enemies of civilization and building an America in peace and security for the future of our children. And accomplishing that defeat of atheistic communism without the tragedy of a Third World War, doing it with steady and sound progress in our America. Now, as I stand before you, as I let my mind flash back over those years to the first meeting, as has been pointed out in this very hall, I'm filled with mixed emotions. Emotions of gratitude, of humility, and of reminiscences of those years in between and what has happened. Gratitude to the men and women of Minnesota and the many of those gathered in this room who played such a significant part in making it possible, working together to do the things that were done in Minnesota, and then sending me forth in these various activities in other parts of our nation and of the world. Gratitude for that. And then a very deep sense of humility. I'm trying to understand what is my responsibility then in the face of the current national and world situation. And I do not doubt that as you gather here, many of you delegates and active leaders in the Republican Party and others just interested citizens and friends from various of the groups in our community and from actually both political parties I know are here tonight, I do not doubt that there's in your mind, as we open this campaign here, questions as to what is the outlook, and we drive toward this goal of changing the national administration and moving in with constructive policies. Well, let me give you a very realistic and a very direct report. And then I trust through the evening I might respond to your questions on either the political situation or on the issues involved. And I hope too, before we close this evening, that I might meet each of you again personally. But what I'd like to say to you first of all about the political situation is that I know full well, as you do, that I stand today in this drive to accomplish this result for the American people in Washington in the third position, the position of the third runner. And so that, first of all, then I want to say to you, what does that mean? As I see it, analyzing it very frankly and forthrightly with you, and since I filed that wonderful slate of men and women at the state capitol here a few days ago, I've been to San Francisco to the national meeting of our Republican Party with the men and women there from all over America. I've been in Illinois where my name has officially been presented in that primary by more than enough petitioners of that great state. I've been up in Connecticut, I've been in Wisconsin where they have that key primary, and I've moved about in other states of the Union, including conferences in Washington. And what I report to you tonight, realistically facing the situation, is that there are indications all over America that the two front runners, those very able men, those very outstanding men, in Senator Taft and General Eisenhower, are clearly in a position where they are tending, through the bitterness of their two camps, to both rapidly prevent the nomination of either one of the two. And that means, as we look together at the political situation, that if the men and women of Minnesota do decide to give a solid support to me in this primary and in this campaign, then there is a very bright chance that in July we secure that nomination that is essential to going on through and doing the job for the American people. Just this last week, one of the keenest and strongest political leaders in my new home state, where I now reside in Pennsylvania, a keystone state, as you know, said to me, if your native home state of Minnesota gives you solid support, and the neighbor state of Wisconsin does the same, then you can count on the solid support of the state of Pennsylvania at Chicago. And just 2 days ago, one of the very keen political leaders of Illinois said that if those two things happen in Minnesota and in Wisconsin, you, for the first time, will have the support of Abraham Lincoln's state of Illinois at the Chicago Convention. Clearly, of course, these are facts of tremendous significance. And I say them to you in this great throng tonight because I recall with such gratitude and such humility the tremendous effort you poured forth in 1948. I remember your trips into Wisconsin, so many of you, and the letters you wrote, and the traveling down to Nebraska, and the effort and the contributions and the giving and the interest that you showed. And I remember, too, your disappointment at the time of the convention in Philadelphia. And so I realized, too, that your thinking would be, well, what is the situation now? And that's why I give you this very frank report on the basis and the beginning from which we enter this campaign drive. And I do want to say to you that if it does come to pass that starting with solid support in Minnesota, we move on then into solid support in Wisconsin and build on up to that key nomination in the National Convention, then in keeping with the way we've always worked together, I want to say to you very frankly, what I do from that point on. What will I do? if it does come to pass that through these sequence of events and the building support across the nation, I become the Republican nominee for the presidency come next July in Chicago. One of the first things I would do would be to move to unite our Republican Party, bringing together all of the groups and the supporters of all the men and all the divergences of view, fitting them together with an understanding and a give and take into a very affirmative, united, vigorous party for the final drive. And I do intend to so conduct these primary campaigns and these pre-convention activities that it is always possible to bring the party together in the final instance and to avoid these bitter, narrow clashes that are springing up between the leading camps and which thereby prevent the successful unity and the drive as we've seen in previous years for final election. Second, I will wage a vigorous fighting campaign against the Truman administration and will not stop until the last ballot is cast by the American people to bring about a change in Washington. We'll never take anything for granted. We won't believe anything's in the bag. Third, I'll present to the American people across the nation a constructive and liberal Republican platform for both domestic and foreign policy. And fourth, and this is tremendously important, and this is one of the things, very directly and frankly, our Republican Party has been weak in for long, many years. Fourth, I will welcome with open arms the support of independents and of Democrats, of men and women of all walks of life, of new voters and of veterans, for a combined drive for clean government and better results for all the people with a new administration in Washington. And with that fourfold approach, the United Republican Party, the vigorous fighting drive against the administration, the constructive platform, and then the bringing in with us of the men and women of the Democratic Party and of independents. I am confident we could drive through to a very sweeping election from the White House down to the courthouse. And then, also in keeping with the way in which we work together in Minnesota, I want to tell you what my pledges are as to what I would then do. Looking to the future rather than to the past, I pledge to you that if these things come to pass, that as your president, I would take these steps. First of all, I would spend less money in the national capital in Washington. Second, I would fire 200,000 loafers now on the federal payroll. You know, when I first said that in a speech a few days ago, one of the leaders of the federal employees wrote to me and said that that wasn't the right thing to say. And he said that indiscriminate, careless, general firing of federal employees would not be the right thing to do. And I answered him and said, I do not propose any careless, indiscriminate general firing. I propose a firing that's precise, that's definite, that's careful, that weeds out the loafers and rewards those that are really doing the work. And then the interesting thing happened was that exchange of letters was published. And now every day, I get letters from federal employees who say to me, they say, you're not only right, but you're underestimating the number of loafers that are on our And to give you some example of just what that is, in the non-defense departments of government, mind you now, the non-defense, the departments that are not engaged in the military and the defense activities, in the last 10 years, the number has gone up from 800,000 to 1,200,000 of employees in the non-defense departments alone. So you can see why so many things are happening. Third, these are these definite pledges. I would clean out and reorganize the State Department of the United States of America. Fourth, I would cut the federal taxes. It's gone too far. Fifth, I would improve the American Farm Program by working directly with the farm organizations, the American Farm Bureau, the Farmers Union, the milk producers, and the National Grange, and I'd work this part out with these organizations through one of the greatest agricultural leaders in America, Senator Ed Thigh of Minnesota. And as I indicated in my opening remarks, I would install a new, firm, and true American foreign policy designed to defeat communism without war. Seventh, I would build America. Establish the Great Lakes St. Lawrence Seaway, develop the Missouri Valley, and advance the natural resources of the nation. Eighth, would maintain sound policies of full employment with jobs for all at worthwhile work and with humanitarian programs for those who were dependent, handicapped, and the truly needy. And ninth, I would end this cheapening of the dollar, which in the last 6 years alone has meant that the dollar today is only worth 68 cents of the dollar when President Truman came into office. I would end that cheapening of the dollar, which is causing such trouble to the wage earners and the pensioners and those with savings and insurance policies. I would end that by establishing a solid American dollar with a modern gold standard to firmly anchor it for the future welfare of the people of our country. Tenth, I would decentralize the federal government and keep the power and the authority close to the American people in their states and in their cities, in their counties, in their towns, in their school districts. And I know well from observing them how the tendency is for bureaucrats to sit in a nation's capital and always try to reach out and grab some more authority and pull the strings in away from the states and the counties and the cities and the school districts. I would reverse the process and send the authority back to the local governments close to the people. 11, I would weed out all disloyal and pro-communist employees off the federal payrolls and keep them off. 12, I would spread profit sharing with employees through American corporations voluntarily across the nation with tax deductions as an incentive for the corporations to develop the profit sharing plans with their employees. 13th, I would keep America strong and alert and well armed without waste of manpower or materials or money. And 14, and perhaps most important of all, I would tell the American people the truth about their own government in both its foreign policy and its domestic policy. Now I realize that many will say that this sounds like a big order. Let me assure you that with the help of a keen, able administration of new and younger men and women, with the counsel and advice of the wisest of the senior Americans, And with the support of Congress and the American people, I am confident that all of these steps can be taken. And in this respect, may I with humility say to you that you will recall that each and every one of the pledges I made to the people of Minnesota in my campaigns for governor, and many of them in this very room, were carried out. The Minnesota budget was balanced and kept balanced. The taxes were cut. The state government payrolls were reduced. The low-grade iron ores and taconite were developed with better employment and business on the Iron Range. And this matter of developing resources, so tremendously important. And many of you, as you think back and recall, the anticipation of the ghost towns on the Iron Range, the gloom about taking out all the rich ore and then leaving an abandoned range, and how at that time, 13 years ago, we changed the tax policies and the state governmental policies to encourage and give a boost to the development of the low-grade iron ores, and today, the Iron Range has a brighter future than it's ever had. Labor peace was established, and the violent, strike-ridden years were ended. And working together, a clean administration of able men and women were installed, and the corrupt and dishonest were thrown out of the state capitol. And one of the best public welfare, health, and education programs of the nation was carried forward. I think you realize that Minnesota now ranks right up number one in the best of health records as to length of life, as to the smallest number of infants who die at childbirth or in the first year, or maternal mortality, or any of those tests of the whole health and welfare program of a state. The debt was reduced. The government was streamlined and needless bureaus were abolished. The highways and airports were improved and well administered. And farmers and workers, businessmen and others, were all given fair treatment through the open front door of the governor's office, and that back door of special favoritism was closed. It was upon this record and the constructive accomplishments of succeeding Republican administrations under Governor Ed Thigh, Governor Luther Youngdahl, and now Governor C. Elmer Anderson that the people of Minnesota have decisively voted Republican for the past 14 years. In this respect, as these pledges were kept in full, I do remember, as you do, that the opposition in 1938 had cynically said that our Boy Scout administration would not be able to keep any of its promises. I say that only in a reflection upon your consideration and that of the people of Minnesota and of the nation, of the pledges we now make. And of course, the things we're pledging for the future of America will not be easy to bring about. But I see in America the whole makings of the kind of working together that can bring about tremendous results in this great country of ours. And if America works together under sound foreign policies that directed keenly against this atheistic communism, then I am confident that we can roll back the dangers of communism without the tragedy of war. We can end the uncertainty of the calls of military service upon the youth of the land. And we can look to a bright future of America under the stars and stripes and under God.
Questions which any of you in the audience have, either about the prospects ahead of this campaign or about the issues in the campaign. Just before this meeting, in fact, for a full hour, from 7 to 8 at the St. Paul Hotel, about 100 young Republicans and college students met with Harold Stassen. They weren't all Stassen supporters. Some of them were wearing buttons of one candidate or another. But they were there with searching questions that they put to him. And they got frank and honest answers. And I know Governor Stassen hopes that some of the people in this audience will have some of those same searching questions. And I'll guarantee to you that in keeping with his policy over the past 12 years then, if not 14, Rhoda, that you will get frank and honest and complete answers. Now, if you wish to ask the question, just raise your hand and I'll attempt to recognize you from the chair, and we'll move on with this meeting to just two or three more short parts. Have I a question anywhere? The gentleman over here.
I'm going to look for New York State. Carry?
How does it look for New York State? New York State, at the present time, looks like the first choice will be about 75 for General Eisenhower and about 21 for Senator Taft. And if the things unfold, as I indicated earlier, it looks like a bright prospect of all 96 of them for me for second choice.
There's another gentleman over here who had a question on the other side of the post.
The questioner says, are we trying to take care of the whole world and letting ourselves go to pieces? And is there an answer to that of trying to do too much in the world? It's a very good question, and it has a lot of meat to it. It is true that America can take on too much of an obligation and try to do too much in the rest of the world and so inflate and weaken its own economy that it will lose its freedom at home. And that's why it's so important that as we work out toward the rest of the world, we do it only on a basis of what will help them help themselves and get on their own feet. We do have a responsibility because we are in such a leading and strong position. But if we do it carelessly, if we do it wrong, just as an example, by pouring out too much aid to England without making a condition that they would not slide into socialism, we really wasted most of our aid to England, because they, in turn, wasted it on socialism and got in deeper and deeper, and today they're really weaker than they were when we started our aid. That's why it's so important that we have conditions on our aid that they build up in a sound manner for their own future, and that we make it clear that they must be self-reliant in these other nations. And in that same process, we have a better chance of making friends. You know, I think we can describe it this way. We're somewhat in a position of the world's leading banker. Whether we like it or not, that's the position America has come to. We are now producing in this country, with 1/16th of the world's peoples, we're producing almost 1/3 of all the world's goods and services. A tremendous development by reason of the basic freedom of the American capitalistic system and political system through the years. Now, because we're in that leading position, we must be a banker toward the world. Now, there are three ways you can be a banker. And I think we've all seen and we know examples of it. We say here in a town, one man goes into a banker and he needs some credit in his business. And the banker just says, well, here it is. No particular questions asked, no suggestions, just here it is. Another banker, another man comes in his business. This banker says, well, I notice that some of your machinery and your goods is spoiling out there for lack of a cover. And I notice, too, that you seem to be pretty careless about your accounts because people have told me that you don't have the right balances. I don't think you can be successful in your business that way. But now, if you put a shed over your supplies, if you put in a young bookkeeper in your accounts, then I'll loan you so and so much money, and we'll go at it that way. These two men who made these two loans met, and the one said, well, I kind of don't like that banker. He made me do some things before he loaned me this money. I kind of don't like him. The other fellow said, oh, my banker's a great fellow. He just gave it to me and asked me no questions. Well, a couple of years later, the fellow that got the loan without any questions asked, he was in trouble. He'd lost the loan, his business was going bad, and then he was talking about this old skinflint banker that wouldn't give him more money. The fellow who first said, oh, that banker's trying to put conditions on me, he'd straightened out his business, he was doing well, he was paying back the loan and going strong. He said, that banker of mine, he's a great fellow, he's a friend of mine. Well, now those are the things. And of course, there's a third kind of a banker, where you come in and you need money, and he just looks at you with a glass eye and he says, no. He don't ask any questions, he don't make any suggestions, he just says no. Well now, what kind of a banker should America be? Should it be a banker that just dishes it out and puts on no conditions? Or should it be a banker that just stiffens up and says no? Or should it be a banker that says to these other countries, now as we see it, there's some things you ought to do to get on your own feet, and if you'll do those things, we'll loan you some money or grant you some money to help you get on your feet. Clearly, the way to do it toward the world is like the wise banker does, and when you do it, you'll make friends at the same time. You do not make friends by trying to be a Santa Claus the year around. Question in the back. Other than the obvious of reducing wages on the federal payroll and the numbers on the federal payroll, how do I propose to cut expenses and reduce taxes? By bringing in just plain efficiency in government. Now let me give you a few examples of it. It can run into hundreds of millions like nothing. One of the very clumsy things that was done in national defense was that a few years ago, the Navy said clearly with the developments in the air, we need bigger carriers. And so they put up all the designs for bigger carriers. They started to build them. And then in some kind of a fit of temper or something, the president stopped it, upset all the plans, disbanded the workmen, wasted the materials. And then along a couple years later, they realized, yes, they did need those big carriers. So now they're suddenly trying to revise the plans and rebuild them. They wasted hundreds of millions of dollars just in that clumsy kind of administrative handling. Let me give you another example. When they decided after the Korea War broke that they needed some more armament, they rushed out to put out some orders for more armament. They forgot that to build armaments, you first have to have raw materials. And so they made all the orders before they went out and reached for the raw materials that you need to build the armament. With the result that they had a chaotic condition in raw materials and the raw materials prices skyrocketed. They also forgot that the very first thing you do in building armament is to have some machine tools. And so the last thing they did was to order the machine tools, which must be the first thing to build the armament. And hundreds of millions of dollars are wasted in that. And you can go in Washington and you find overlapping bureaus. You find them getting in each other's way. You find the most terrible kind of a wasteful situation. The national government, in all of its ramifications, is in worse mismanaged condition today than the Benson administration was before we threw it out of office in Minnesota. And when in Minnesota, you'll remember that we cut down the cost 20% and we gave the people better service after we cut the cost 20%. So those are some of the kind of ways that with good, honest, efficient men and women, we'll cut down the federal budget, and we'll cut down the taxes of the people of the country.
You briefly mentioned the improved state of health in Minnesota. Would you comment on your plans for a national health?
I briefly mentioned, the questioner says, the improved state of health in Minnesota. Would I comment briefly on my plans as to national health? America does have, as a whole, the best health record of any major nation in the world. But that's not good enough. In other words, we should not be smug or complacent about it. There's still room for great improvement in the health of the people of this country, and there's particular need of improvement when a very serious illness or serious accident hits a family, drains all their funds, and puts them in a serious economic position. We must work out some way of further improving the Blue Cross and the various plans. Now, how should we do it? I feel that we absolutely should do it working with the doctors and the hospitals and the nurses. We should have no health program that is not approved by the medical profession and, as the case may be, the hospital associations and the nursing groups. Working with them, perhaps even prodding them a little bit at times and saying, how are we going to get going on this particular problem? I'm convinced we can make steady progress on the basis of free and independent medicine, not socialized, and steadily advance in the health conditions of our country. But I am definitely against the socialized medicine of the British kind, which has had a sad result in Britain, and I am against any plan that you try to jam down the throats of the doctors who must make it work. One of my pledges was to keep America well armed. Do I include universal military training in that plan? No, not in its present proposal. This is my proposal of the way the armament program on manpower ought to be. Let me first say that I think the worst part of the present situation is the uncertainty that faces young men. They do not know when they'll be called, or they think that they won't be and then they are, or they're going to be called and then they're not. They're in the reserves and they get a notice and it's canceled, or then they're called in and then it's extended. And that whole uncertainty is the worst part of the present military service. Now, it is my proposal that we say that for the American armed program, during these years, until we get these communists going downhill so we don't have to have such a big army, during these years, we say to every young man when he becomes 17, sometime between now and when you're 27, you've got to give some service to your country. And we'll say, here's five different ways you can do it. And you can say now when you want to do it and which of the five plans. You can say you want to go right in now when you're 17 and do your 2 years and get it over with. Or you can say, I want to go in when I'm 18 when I graduate from high school. Or you can say, I want to wait till I study engineering or medicine or graduate here or there, and then I'm coming in as a young officer and I'm going to serve so long. Or you can say, I want to take military training and then be in the reserve so many years. Or I want to be in ROTC. You give them different choices and then let them pick their choice and say when they want to do it, and then that's the program. And on that definite basis, you can keep America strong, and you have the young men have a sense that they've made some choice in it, and they know when they have to serve. Because some young men would like to get in and get it over with and get through. Others, for family reasons or other reasons, would like to postpone it till they get their education. But this way, when you set up examinations and boards and you change the rules, it's a very chaotic situation for the young people. And as one of the alternatives, I would give them a chance to take a military training and then be in what might be called the first reserves. And you'd say to all of them, you do what one of these alternatives says, and then unless there's a major war, you're not going to be called again. And then keep the bargain with them and do not change the rules on them in each session of Congress or each meeting of the Chiefs of Staff. Now that's my program for manpower for the military. Aren't the military camps and training, the questioner says, set up on a certain basis? And if these youngsters choose in such a way that there'd be a tremendous influx 1 year and then not the other year, wouldn't that put a great strain on the economy? The actual experience has been in both Sweden and in Switzerland that the young men make varied choices, and they're quite similar from year to year. Now, of course, one man can't say he's going to report Thursday morning at 9 o'clock and the other man Friday afternoon at 3 o'clock. I didn't mean you'd give him that kind of a choice. I mean that he might have to report, we'll say, the 1st of January, the 1st of March, the 1st of July, the 1st of September, and you fit them into your camp program. But actually, year after year, young men will divide in their choices about the same way, and you can fit your camp program to it actually with less cost than they are now doing. And that, as I say, is demonstrated in the efficient experience of both Sweden and Switzerland. There's a questioner down here.
How is your new modern goal standard made different from the goal standard that you had prior to the Depression?
How is the new modern goal standard going to be different than the goal standard we had back prior to the Depression? First of all, you cannot go back to the old value of gold and the dollar. In other words, when you've inflated up to this level, you cannot deflate back down, or you have terrible dislocation in the economy, you have unemployment and many serious conditions. So you have to start wherever you are when you're going to level off. But the basic thing you're trying to do is to keep the inflation from going on up and the dollar from being cheaper, and also to prevent it from deflating downward. So you put into effect, on the one hand, the balanced budget, and then with it, the policy of full employment, which means that if you reach a stage where you no longer need so much armament, you start doing these great public improvements, like Great Lakes, St. Lawrence Seaway, Missouri Valley, highways, and things like that, so you keep your employment up. That's an important part of a modern gold standard. You level off the value at wherever you are when you get a chance to take hold and do it. Another thing that's modern about it is you cannot let gold move in and out of the country freely like you used to, because the rest of the world is in such chaotic conditions. So you must set up a control over the movement of gold in and out of your country. Otherwise, for example, the communists could take slave labor, push real hard, mine a lot of gold, and then suddenly dump it in here and upset your money market. Or a group of countries could save up their dollars, suddenly come in here and buy up gold and pull it out, and that could upset your market. So a part of the modern approach is that with these world conditions, you've got to have controls over the movement of gold in and out of the country. Another thing that's modern about it is that you would have to provide some limits on the holding of gold by a citizen, so they couldn't hoard large quantities of it. In other words, they could hold some, but there'd have to be a limit of it. Those are the kind of conditions you'd have to put on so that it's modern in the sense that it fits the current world situation, it fits the place where the dollar is, and it stabilizes from that time on, so from then on you know what you're planning on. There are a few other technicalities, but those are the main points of it. I might say, if you're especially studying that, I made a major speech on it in Connecticut last week. And if you write, I'll send you the whole speech. Questioner back there. What state is General Eisenhower from? He was born in Kansas, I believe, and is now a legal resident of New York. Yes, he bought a farm in Pennsylvania, that's true. I had a good visit with General Eisenhower, and I correctly figured out that he was not coming back here in January, as they claimed he was, to take off his uniform and lead the fight against President Truman. I mean, I figured out in December that he was not going to do that, which they claimed he was going to do, and therefore I felt that the right thing for me to do was to step in and to begin to lead the vigorous fight against President Truman to throw him out of the White House. The question is that in the employee-employer plan and profit sharing, do I have in mind something similar to the Hormo plant, which developed so successfully in our own state? Yes, that's one of the possibilities. In other words, to leave it voluntarily up to the corporation and their employees, but provided it's genuine and it's fair and it cuts the employees in on the profit side, then give them a break that they pay less federal taxes because it's good for the whole economy to do it. And you're right, the Hormo plant is one of the examples. There are now 2,500 companies in America that have different plans along that line. And if we could make it so 250,000 companies in America were doing it, we'd have a much stronger economy and we'd end so much of this strife and bitterness that exists. The way it is now, if one of our big corporations announces a very large profit for a year, well, that in a way properly indicates they've had a successful year. But the employees of that company have a feeling antagonistic about that announcement of a big profit. I want to change that, so when the big profit is announced, employee Sam Jones says to himself, that means something extra for Martha and the children. And if we bring that about, then we'll start a different atmosphere in the relationships between labor and capital and the whole economy in America. And this antagonism between labor and capital over a period of years is what caused the British economy to be pulled down and topple over the heads of both labor and capital. And I do not want to see that happen in America. So I'm seeking the way in which we have labor as well as capital have a stake in the profits of the company. Well, I want to thank you for your... Hello, Sam. I want to thank you for your alert attention and your wonderful interest in being here. And to say to you, it's thrilling to be back with you. It's going to be a terrific campaign, and I'll deeply appreciate your help in every possible way. And I look forward to seeing you at the back of the hall as we leave, but I notice before we do that, we're going to have a little music coming in back there.
Meeting just for a moment or two, will you all keep your seats?